The following presentation was recorded at the 2001 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Well, good morning. I find it interesting or challenging to share in a situation where we have fans whirring all the time and we're on the edge of our comfort zones here in terms of heat. But it's good to be here this morning. I'd like to begin with a question. From your reading of the Gospels, how much time did Jesus spend with one person in any given day? If you think back through the Gospels, little interactions that Jesus had with people, pretty significant moments from what we can tell. In fact, probably life-directing moments, pro or con. Most likely, he did not spend, at least from what we can tell, he doesn't spend a lot of time with these people. Jesus never seems to force anyone. I go jogging a lot, and sometimes I realize that I haven't looked to the right or the left for the last mile. I'm just kind of focused. For one thing, maybe I'm thinking I can't keep going much longer. So I'm just focused right there, you know. And I ran past a friend's house the other morning, and he yelled out at me, sitting on his front porch, and he said, "Hey." Well, I didn't see him sitting out there. He was relatively close to the road. Now, it strikes me that Jesus, if we want to stay self-absorbed in our own little piece of the pie, he lets us. Jesus doesn't force anybody. He never compels people to do what he wants them to do. He never forces them. If you want to live that way, he'll let you live that way. What does he do, however? We read the Gospels and we hear Jesus asking compelling questions. We hear him making some very powerful parallels, telling some very powerful stories. And he offers some powerful insights, especially to those who seek. Let's just consider one familiar story in the Gospels, the rich young ruler. He comes to Jesus and asks what I believe was a sincere question. He says, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Doesn't seem to be a trick question. And Jesus replies, "Well, you know the commandments. Don't steal, don't murder." And so on. And the ruler says, "Well, all of these have I kept from my youth up." But you see, he was still asking the question. And so Jesus replies, "Well, if you want to be perfect, you lack one thing." In one of the Gospels, it says that he looked on him and he loved him. I think Jesus liked this guy. And he said, "One thing you lack, go sell everything you have, give it to the poor and come follow me." And the ruler walked away sorrowful, it said. Jesus touched the one chord in his life that really mattered. Now, I want you to notice something. Jesus didn't go running after him and say, "Now, wait a minute. Have you thought about the ramifications of your decision here?" He didn't run after him and say, "Wait, have you thought about the benefits of following me?" He didn't even ask, "What are you feeling right now?" Okay. He didn't ask any of those questions. He let him walk away. I'd like to suggest that all of these things impact our approach to students. That we often perhaps assume more responsibility than we ought to. Now granted, there's a few differences here. Our students are younger. We're with them every day. We don't have these once-in-a-lifetime encounters. It's pretty daily. And so we have opportunities, different dynamics, different purposes perhaps, different goals. And yet, I want us to consider the fact that people make choices. And certainly there are reasons to have compassion, there are reasons to spend time. And yet we need to recognize that God works in people's lives. People make choices. I am not ultimately responsible for those choices. I believe that changes. For me, it takes the fear out of these encounters that I have with people every day. I'm called to live and speak the truth and to do it in love and compassion. Do it in the humility that grows out of awareness of my own humanity. But it removes the fear, it removes some of the pressure. I don't have to be perfect with this student. I'm called to live the truth and to speak the truth. Today I'm going to suggest that we need three things in order to counsel students, and these are broad categories, but there are three things. Number one, you need to know yourself. Number two, you need to know your students. And number three, you need a clear organizational framework within which to disciple students. Basically, what I'm talking about there is what's your school like? If we're going to do well at discipling, counseling, mentoring students, we need to know something about ourselves. We need to know our students well, and we need policies and procedures in place that enable us to be effective in our discipling. Well, what does it mean to know yourself? And I'm just going to cover this rapidly. This one often seems simplistic. We've heard philosophers and sages over the centuries, you know, wag the finger and say, above all else, know yourself. Well, what does that mean? John Calvin begins his Institutes of the Christian Religion with this assertion. He says the two most important kinds of knowledge in the world are the knowledge of God and the knowledge of ourselves. But, he continued, these two kinds of knowledge are so closely connected that it is difficult to know which one comes first. In other words, we cannot know who we are unless we know God. And if we know God, we will know who we are. And I find that is so true in my life. The more I come to know God, the more I see myself as I truly am. I see places where I've been fearful, wasn't even aware of it. I see places where I've been stubborn, not even aware of it. All these things grow as we come to know God more and we know ourselves. The point is, I don't want us to fall over completely to the side and say, well, all you need to do is know God. I don't think that's an adequate statement. We do. From our standpoint, we need to know God. In that process, I believe, we come to know ourselves. But here's the point. We need to know God in a way that transforms our lives. We need to know where we're obstinate, fearful, and blind, and rebellious ourselves. We need to remember that God had mercy on us. We need to know how He's changed us. How did He, after all, enable me to overcome that besetting sin, that habit, that way of relating to people? How did I actually manage to change? How did God change me? Those are some of the things I think we need to know. Let me just suggest a few categories for understanding this. These in order. We need a relationship with Jesus Christ that reminds us that He is always at work in us. Whenever I stand with a student, another stands with me. I think that's a crucial understanding, that another person stands with me. Secondly, I'm a seeker. I'm often aware when I'm sitting and talking to a student that I really don't have the answer here. I'm struggling myself. So what are the issues? What is the issue here? And I find that I need to be a seeker always. There are answers, but you need to seek them. Jesus says, ask, seek, knock. Proverbs 2 says that you need to seek after it like hidden treasure, crying aloud. That sounds pretty passionate to me, pretty desperate in seeking for truth. I'm just suggesting five ways to do that. Relationship with God and others. Need to read, always learning, observe other people. We can be taught by others, be equipped, and then we need to go out and do it with the confidence that God will continue to give us the insight and knowledge that we need. You know, there comes a point, and it'll happen here in a couple of weeks, you'll have to stand up in front of people and start teaching, even though you're very much aware that you don't know it all, and you may even think you don't know enough. But guess what? Stand up and start talking. Stand up and begin to teach and lead and disciple students. And it's in that process that we learn more. And we need to do that in the confidence that God's going to be faithful to us. Number three, I'm just going to suggest you need to abandon yourself to God. And what I mean here is that you need to trust that God will indeed do something good in and through you. That takes trust. It means I'm going to risk. I'm going to give it all I've got, even though I think I may be an apparent failure. I'm going to give it all I have, even though I'm not doing so well. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to be invincible to begin counseling students. Number four, I want to develop a passion for the kingdom of God. What I want us to do here is to look at our students and see their needs, to look at our own lives, see our own needs, to look around the world and see the needs, to look at what God is calling us to, what God wants to do, look at the difference and say, God, what needs to happen? What needs to happen? What can I do? There's something's got to happen. Developing a passion for the kingdom of God. And then number five, a very much related word, compassion. Out of that passion for the kingdom will grow a compassion for people. The same kind that Jesus had when he came, looked out over the multitudes and had compassion. He saw them as sheep without a shepherd. I can see their situation more clearly. Well, not only do I need to know myself, I need to know my students. Who are my students? I look out over that room. And if it's not my first year, I know something about them. I know a little bit about their homes. I know a little bit about their personalities. I know a little bit about what they like, what they don't like. But I need to ask myself, you know, who do they admire? What do they want? How do they learn? How do they grow? How do they change? Big questions. Questions I find myself wrestling with all the time. You know, as I look at my students, what do I want? Am I satisfied with just external behavior? As long as everybody obeys the rules, I'm happy. Is that what I want in my students? Do I want more Pharisees? That's what I'm going to suggest that is. I'm raising little Pharisees. If I'm satisfied, everybody does the right thing. You know, that really is the easiest thing for me. If they just do it, do what I want. It really makes life easy for me. And in my darker moments, I kind of wish they would just be that way. It'd be a lot easier. I could just do my thing and they can do theirs and we all get along happily ever after. But it's not that easy. I don't want to raise little Pharisees. So how am I going to relate to my students in a way that calls for something more? What do I know about them that's going to do that? I remember my first day here at Faith Builders. I remember talking to my students, and I was new in the community, had moved in a month earlier. I didn't know any of them. It's a brand new place, brand new people. Felt pretty big. Maybe some of you are facing that this year. I don't know. But I didn't even know their families, didn't know their grandparents, didn't know anything about them. Felt a lot different than it did teaching my home community. But I remember a few months later, as one of the parents was talking to me, you know, they said, you know, these students came home the first day, and they said, you know, we think we're going to like the principal. We think we're going to like him, which I was relieved to hear that. And they said, you know, he cares about us. Okay, now, I had no idea that they could actually read that in a day's time. I mean, I did. But I was surprised as anybody that they understood something about the fact that I cared about them. Now, how did they pick that up? I don't know. I really don't know. I could maybe suggest some ideas. The point is that I want to leave with you here is that your life makes a statement. I consistently underestimate the message of my life. I mean, it's just me, right? I mean, who am I? I had no idea they're going to pick that up. And I find that that is so true with people, that we consistently underestimate the message, the impact of our life. Let me suggest some ways that you can communicate that kind of compassion for your students. I'm going to suggest that it's in the way you talk about people. You make fun of them. You kind of scorn them. Is sarcasm your favorite technique in humor? It wasn't mine when I started teaching. I love sarcasm. I think it can be very funny. However, when I have adolescents or younger students in front of me, if that's the way I talk all the time, that's kind of the way I talk about issues and people, I can guarantee you there's going to be a little bit of a wall there between you and your students. Because perhaps even the subconscious, unconscious assumption they're going to read into that is, you know, one of these times he's going to talk about me that way. I don't even know what the assumption is, but I just know it creates a wall. I'm not sure what the conclusions are that people make. But there's just a little barrier there that comes with sarcasm. So it's how I talk about issues in other people. It's how I relate to people. Do I look them in the eye? Is my gaze warm and inviting? Or am I kind of aloof and businesslike and I keep things very proper and so on? Or do I invite something in the way I relate to people? I look them in the eye. I square my body. I don't sit there and kind of talk to them this way. But I turn to them and invite and engage them. I notice people. Hi, how are you? I say their names. Someone has said that the best music in anyone's ear is the sound of their own name. I noticed that the other night I went to a person's house here in the community. I don't know him real well, but throughout the evening, I remember when he especially wanted to make a point, he said my name. But Brandon, isn't it true? You know, that somehow grabbed me a little bit and caught my attention. You know, one of the opportunities you have to communicate this is how you relate in informal settings, before school, after school, recess, Walmart. Walked into Walmart one time and somebody yelled halfway across the lobby there, Mr. Mollett! I'm like, this is Walmart, you know. I don't know. Of course, this student has good lungs. And, you know, I made sure I went over right away so I didn't have to holler twice. But at all those places, how we relate to them sends a message. But your life communicates something. I'd like to notice just briefly how Jesus related to people. He knew people. He knew who they were. I'd like to look at three different situations. Let's consider Bartimaeus. And I won't read the passage, you know it. But old blind Bartimaeus, calling, shouting, crying aloud. Jesus said, I'm not too busy to talk to him. I'm not too busy. He invited him to come over. He said, what do you want? Notice he didn't assume anything. Here's the guy is blind. He said, what do you want from me? I think it's a powerful question to ask our students. What do you want? What do you want? Cuts to the chase. Well, Bartimaeus had a very short answer. Lord, I want to see. I want to see. And Jesus healed him. What about the road to Emmaus? A little longer time of interaction here. A little longer time. Jesus walked alongside. He listened. He said, what's going on? They said, haven't you heard? And so they talked to him. He built some rapport with them. And then he began to share with them. And they left saying, didn't our hearts burn within us? Didn't we know that we were in the presence of someone who knew something that we didn't know? This person was special. Notice the impact of Jesus' life without even knowing who he was. His life spoke. Notice that Jesus always had time. I want to notice one other example. When Mary came into the house of Simon the Pharisee and began to weep and wash Jesus' feet with her tears and wipe them with her hair. And of course, Simon was critical. And Jesus said, you know, Simon, she's doing this because she's been forgiven much. She's been forgiven much. Notice again, Jesus didn't turn away. It was a very strange, may I say, moment. I think sitting around, reclined around a table, this woman, who everyone knows her reputation, comes in and does something very vulnerable and intimate to Jesus. Jesus didn't turn her away. He didn't shame her at all. He had time. And he blessed and forgave. He spoke the healing word to her. Jesus had time for people. People were permitted to state their problems in their own way and time. Jesus didn't have any prejudice. Mary's act there was certainly not socially acceptable. But Jesus didn't let that stop him from meeting her need. Jesus listened. He understood. He spoke. The problem is we're pretty quick to think we understand. We're pretty quick to think that we know what the problem is. Let me just suggest something as we listen to our students, as we bring our knowledge of our students to bear on the situation at hand. Three things about listening. Listening involves perception and discernment. Perception and discernment. So you have 1 minute with a student outside the classroom door before the next class. You bring everything to bear. And of course, you know that you're in a hurry. You have to get one more thing yet before the bell rings. But here's this student who needs your attention. You better listen well. Perception and discernment. And here's what I think is important in that quick little moment. As I bring all of that, almost without thinking about it, bring it to bear. As I listen to this student who I know, I've had all kinds of interaction, I say, what do you want? And or I saw them do something and I immediately tackle the problem. I need to do something that some counselors say this way, go with your gut. Okay, it's a pretty earthy term, but go with your gut. In other words, what am I feeling? What's going on here? So let's say I saw Johnny kick the person in the drinking fountain line just a minute ago. Okay. Now, if you're like me, there's just a little tinge of anger that comes when I see that happen. I want to get him for that. Okay. I don't like that. Mistreating somebody. Okay. Now, if you don't, let's say I know Johnny and let's say I know that he really does need, right there, he needs to just be, that behavior needs to be labeled for what it is. He's be told that he was wrong and needs to be sent to his seat without restroom or drink privileges. Okay. Now, if I doubt myself right there, oh, I'm angry. I shouldn't be angry. Okay. Well, immediately, I'm not able to do really what Johnny needs. But it's okay to say, Johnny, and put it to him right there. Or let's say that I know another student who's very timid, and they come in crying, and they say, so-and-so didn't let me take part in the game at recess, and they said I was too fat to play this game. Okay, now again, let's say I just have 1 minute to do this. 1 minute. And I know a little something about Sally, and I've told her that I care about her. She knows I care about her. She knows that I know about this problem, and she knows that we've talked about things she can do to be a friend to people. I don't have to spend a lot of time making sure she knows I care before I speak the truth into that situation. I simply need to speak. So let me just encourage you, go with your gut. What am I feeling? What needs to be said right here? I need to trust a little bit that God knows my heart. The student knows I care. I'm going to speak the truth. And it may be a little pointed. It may call them to something pretty sharply, but they know I care. Second thing about listening. Listening well frees your student to listen. I remember sitting down with a person one time, and we just had 10 minutes, and I had something I wanted to share with them and get a little feedback. And we sat down across the table, and this person leaned forward across the table and listened to me. She listened as I laid out the situation, and then she all of a sudden she sat back, very relaxed, and was like, oh. And I knew without her saying a word that she had heard me completely. And I was ready to hear what she had to say. Listening well frees your students to listen to you when you speak. So often I come to a situation and I think I know. Now this is kind of the other side of go with your gut, see? But underneath all of this, I'm suggesting that listening is the bottom line. I'm going to listen. If first of all I listen, it frees the student to listen when I speak. And number three, listening is an act of love. Listening is an act of love. When I listen well, I observe the person, I know the person. I'm not judging or critiquing them. I'm reading all the signs I can possibly. I'm reading the fear on their face, or I'm reading the anger on their face. I'm reading what they're doing with their hands. They're fidgeting, you know, or they're in their pockets. I'm reading the whole person when I listen. But I don't do that to judge or critique. I do it as an act of love because I want to hear everything I possibly can hear from that person, and then I want to speak. Number three in this discussion here about counseling, mentoring, and discipling students, I need a framework within which to counsel. Imagine for a moment if you came to school and no one knew when class started, there were no bells, no one knew what would happen if they got out of their seat without permission, no one would know what would happen if they mouthed back to a teacher, nothing was in place. We just kind of all gather and we hope something good happens. Obviously, we'd have chaos in a few minutes. You need a framework within which to disciple students. And here's where we're going to get more practical as we think about counseling and discipling. What is your school? Different people have talked this week already about what is communicated, that when you walk into a school, you sense the character, the atmosphere of the school. Let me suggest a couple things that you need in place in your school. And these are just recapping. You don't need to take notes on all these. Recapping some things we talked about this week already. But you need a clear reason for existence. You need to know why you're there. And it's more than just teaching a few subjects. But you need to know why you're there. And it ought to be stated in a concise way. You need parents who are behind you. And you need clear, established procedures for everyone. You need a motivated, loyal staff. You need discipline policies. You need all these things in place in your school. What are some of these established policies? Well, number one, I'm going to suggest you need a communication policy. know who to talk to. In our school, we say specifically that the parent should come and talk to the teacher if they have a problem. The student should come and talk to the teacher if they have a problem. The parent should not go and talk to the board before they talk to the teacher. Students don't go talk to other students before they come talk to the teacher. Teachers don't go talk to other teachers or other parents or other people in the community about the problems. We couch all that in Matthew 18. People need to know who to talk to. You need established procedures. You need a discipline policy that sets out the procedures for discipline. What happens when a child misbehaves? Well, the teacher will talk to the student, number one. Number two, if that's not effective, they will go to the principal. Number three, if that's not effective, the principal will call the parent. Okay? If there's not a response there, we'll take it to the entire faculty along with the parents and we'll discuss possible solutions to the problem. Okay? If that's not effective, we're going to take it to the board and we're going to suggest either suspension or expulsion. Okay? Now, that's the procedure, and we even spell out more specifically what happens with suspension, what happens with expulsion, what happens if we agree to take them back after they've been expelled. They're on probation. What is probation? We spell it out. Okay, within that framework, that gives me great freedom when I talk to a student because I'm not left what happens if they don't respond. I know, I've thought through, I understand what's supposed to happen. Okay? Now, there are still questions within that framework. Times we wrestle, what do we do? Okay? However, that framework gives me a great sense of security as I relate to students. I'm much more free to speak. I know what I want here. I know the path if this doesn't work out. So I want a clear discipline policy. Well, let's move now to the more daily things. What are ways that I can counsel and disciple students? Let me suggest a number of ways. There are informal ways. Informal ways that I can talk to students. I can write them a note. At the end of the day, I'm reflecting back, and I noticed that Sally was crying after recess, and I didn't have time. I noticed she stopped crying eventually, and she was able to work, so I let her go. Okay, I let her go on working. I didn't know what the problem was. So after school, I thought, you know, I failed to follow up on that. I'm just going to write her a quick note and say, hey, I noticed. Let me know if I can help. That's all it will take, and that student may come. Another way is I can make phone calls. Sometimes students will call me. And there is a limit to this. There are times when I didn't appreciate the phone calls. There are times when I have to sort of cut it short. But phone calls can be effective. Number three, one-minute chats. And these are some of the examples I already gave you earlier. A little one-minute chat, say, what's the problem? Okay, let me tell you how I see it. And we just go from there. Again, those one-minute chats are normally couched in a larger context, that context of the fact that this student knows I care, I've taken some time to listen well, and I'm just going to say what I think is the problem, what I think needs to happen. One of the dilemmas I found when I came here. I hadn't taught much in a conventional classroom when I came to Faith Builders. I taught for 5 years in an individualized classroom. And one of the things I noticed immediately was that there's some difference here in what I'm able to do with students. I have to change my approach. In the individualized classroom, I have time. I mean, every morning I go around and check goals. I check in with that student. That the approach, that philosophy and approach to education emphasizes more personal discipleship, at least in a unique way, because I go around every morning and I look at the goals. In fact, the student is encouraged to set their own goals. That has to do with character and discipleship right there. The student sets their own goals. They plan what they want to get done. I help them. I coach them in setting good goals and making sure they accomplish them. Okay? Well, during that time, I have tremendous opportunities in that circuit around my classroom. Say, how you doing? Why isn't this done? What's the problem? What needs to happen? Well, let's talk about that. Okay, did you talk to your dad last night about this problem? No. Okay, well, why not? What's going on? You didn't talk to your dad. I have all kinds of opportunities, wonderful opportunities to talk to the student on a personal level, disciple. I come here, the bell rings, you have 35 minutes to teach the lesson, make sure they know how to do it. You give them the assignment, bell rings, you have a couple minutes, next class. You get the picture. I have a problem. I don't know how I'm going to meet the needs of my students, and I see bad things happening all the time. Okay? How do I address those? Well, I had to change my tactics. I had to say things in front of the class sometimes that normally I would have saved for a private moment. This time I call it, I call it like it is in front of the classroom. Well, there's something good about that too. You know, we live in community. And so the whole community, the classroom, saw the misbehavior. The student chose to talk, right, in the classroom. So I don't have to wait for the private moment, or the student chose to be mouthy, or the student chose to be whatever. I can say it right there. I don't have to wait for the private moment to confront it. And so we live in community, and sometimes I think that's a little bit more like real life than always having the private moment that the individualized classroom offers me. I think there's room for both, and I appreciate both. But just to say that both have their advantages and disadvantages, okay? So in this conventional classroom, I'm going to go for the study hall if I need more time, or I'm going to go for lunch. If I need more time, I'm going to pull them out. I'm going to try to make it rare that I pull them out of another teacher's class to talk to them. If I do need to, I'm going to talk to the teacher and say, okay, I need 10 minutes with Johnny. Can I have it out of your math class? And the teacher will say yay or nay, and that's fine. I'll try to find a slot to do that. But study halls are a good time. Recess. Already mentioned lunch. But recess is a time when you can do that. Student may not appreciate it, but it's a time you can use. Phys ed class, another class, I've done that. Pulled them out. After all, phys ed's rather unnecessary, right? It's not. It's very necessary, I think. I like the class, but it is a time when they may not miss as much content. Those are informal ways. What are some formal ways that we can counsel and disciple students? I have here in front of me what I call a game plan. I'd already taught this student for 2 years, and it was beginning of the third year, and I told this student, you know, before you come this year, I want some understandings in place. And you decide whether or not you want to be here. If you can't agree to this, don't even bother coming. So the date at the top of this paper is August 30. Okay? Beginning of the year. And so we made a list of understandings before this student ever came to school. Now, a few days later, the student sort of hit a wall. Early on, the student had agreed to this paper, and the student came to my office and said, you know, I'm dumb. I can't learn. I'm getting bad grades. I can't do this stuff. And she had a point. Okay? She had a point. Learning was difficult. Now, notice, though, that it was the framework of expectation that brought her to that point. If I'd have just said, come on in, put my arm around, and you can, you know, we're glad to have you here, and then this stuff starts popping, you know, all this bad stuff starts popping out, and I have to deal with it one at a time, and I'm caught off guard, and so on. No, I brought in the framework. The student knows I care. Okay, we've had 2 years already. I've done a lot of listening. I gave the framework, dealt with the bad stuff before it happened, right? Now the stuff underneath comes up. I hate myself. I don't believe in my, I can't learn. I'm embarrassed in the classroom all the time. And so we sat down and we said, okay, what needs to happen here? What is actually true in your life at this moment? And again, I wasn't calling her just to believe something in her head and not engage her heart. Again, remember, I said that I understood this person. But we said, number one, you have to accept what God has given. And maybe God didn't precisely give all of it, the bad things that happened in your life, but this is where you are, this is who you are. Can we agree that you can't go anywhere as long as you stay mad about the fact that you can't learn, that it's tough? Yeah, we finally got to the point after a few minutes. Yeah, I won't be getting anywhere unless I accept the fact that this is me. Okay. Well, number two, can we agree that you can focus on learning what you can to the very best of your ability? So you can't. So you don't do well at this, but you do pretty well at this. At least you get pretty decent grades in this area. How about focusing on that and really going for the gusto in that as a way to help me stay positive about some other things? Okay, yeah, I can agree to do that. Okay, number three, can we learn or can we agree that school is more than academics? That learning is more than academics? In other words, I need to learn things like self-discipline, so I don't spout off in middle of class, self-control, concentration, wanting to get up and get a drink every 10 minutes, you know, wanting to go up and sharpen my pencil. Can I throw this in the wastebasket? Can I? Everything to stay away from the hard work. And we understood it was hard work to learn. But concentration, perseverance, endurance during difficulty. We talked about endurance. We talked about saying, you know, God made me. I need to accept that. And I'm going to persevere no matter what. And so then I shared a few scripture passages that I thought were succinct one-liners that may be helpful to keep in front of her. We talked about Proverbs 14:30, a heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. So envy. My sister can do so much better than this. Why can't I? It makes me mad. I don't want to do this. I'm tired of trying to do this when I always get bad grades. A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. Okay. How about Proverbs 24:10? If you falter in times of trouble, how small is your strength? If you falter in times of trouble. And I just told her, I said, I know that your trouble is more than a lot of your classmates. I know it is. So when I ask you to not to falter, I know I'm asking a lot. You see here the compassion, the understanding, okay? But this is where you are. This is who you are. What do you want to do about it? That's really the question. What do you want to do? Or Proverbs 24:24, a man's steps are directed by the Lord. How then can anyone understand his own way? I wanted to cast a little bit of vision here. I said, you know what? You have no idea what God wants to do through your life and the story of your life. I just believe that God wants to do something good through your life. How can you understand what God wants to do? So this is hard, but maybe God can do something really outstanding in your life. And so I suggested several practical ways to do that. Make a list of good things in your life. What are the good things? The list of the bad, I would agree, is longer than the good. But there's a long list of good things. Talk about your feelings to one or two people. In other words, you need to share with somebody What's going on? And I suggest another person so it wouldn't be me all the time. Okay, I suggest another good person in this student's life. Because I frankly did not have time to listen as much as what I knew this student would want someone to listen. But I did know there was someone else, an older lady in her church, who would. We'll talk about that more later. And then we talked about growing in the whole area of gratitude and trust, focusing on the good things, being grateful, crying about the bad things, and we keep going. Game plans. A second way that you do this is in teaching. Sometimes we think that we counsel and disciple only in the one-on-one situation. I want to suggest that we do it a lot in the way that we teach. Number one, we teach truth. We give them the ideas and the understandings that enable them to deal with what's going on in their lives. Secondly, we model it. And I just want to suggest that your student will deeply appreciate the occasional time when you share a moment that was tough for you, especially if you go back. I wouldn't recommend that you share too much out of your present struggle. Because they're not equipped, nor is it fair, I don't think, or right, that you kind of dump out on your students like that. But when you share the past struggles and things that you've had, and they know, they may even know that you have an occasional bad day, but you can model what it takes, what it looks like when a believer is honest about where they are and their struggle to trust God, and their struggle to move ahead in whatever situation they're facing. So you can model that. That's the way we do that. Other ways that we can counsel and disciple our students. Activities. Evenings out. At our school in Indiana, we had a tradition that the teachers took out, the principal took the guys out for supper one night and maybe played volleyball or played a game of some kind, and one of the ladies took the ladies out. Just some more informal time, spending time together. Every summer we took a canoe trip, an overnight canoe trip. A great time where we could have a lot of fun, sit around the campfire and talk, play games. Just some good interaction there. I already mentioned lunch, but what I want to add here is that I would occasionally, and again, I could do this because of the individualized classroom. I've done very little of this here except to sit in the cafeteria over lunch. But occasionally, I would take a student out to lunch. We'd go to Arby's or McDonald's or something. I only do this a few times a year, but occasionally, I would do that. And we sit down and say, okay, let's talk. Let's talk about what's going on here. And we would do that over lunch. Take an hour and do that. One of the helpful things that I've done, it's been very helpful with some students, especially those that don't talk, you don't know where they are, you have a tough time, they don't achieve well, not sure what all is going on, maybe you have a tough time getting parents involved. I've given them a notebook and I said, this is your notebook. Of course, this is after I talk to the parents, but I give this notebook to the student. This is your notebook. You need to carry it back and forth from school and home every day. Every night it goes home with you. Every morning it comes back. And most evenings I would write a little note in there of some kind. So Bill did really well in math today. He got an 85% on the quiz. Or I'll send home. I saw Bill encourage another student today. One or two sentences that I write in there, but I try to stay positive and affirming. I notice the good things. And then I try to get Dad and Mom to write something in response, or for them to write something in the notebook. And this is where it's tough. I mean, not only is it tough in terms of time, but some dads have a real struggle with this. But it's a way to help them begin to articulate what they really feel in their heart about their child. It's in there. It's just hard to talk about. And so that notebook has been very effective, and I've seen students make tremendous changes in their life through this. Those are the activities. Some more formal ways. Let's just talk about a couple resources that I think you need to take advantage of as a teacher. Take advantage of the people in your community. And this is for your more difficult situations. But work with your a local person. So this example I gave you earlier, there's a lady here in the community who worked with this family for years. Okay, well, why should I try to reinvent the wheel? There's no point. In fact, she could probably do it better than me because she's a mom. She knows the family from way back. And so she's going to do well. And so I'm just going to call her. Hey, Sally had a bad day in school today. Can you call her and talk to her? Okay, here's what happened. Here's my perspective. I'll let you deal with it. I even one time called her to come to the school and meet with the student. And she was very willing to do that. Spent 2 hours with the student. That I knew that if something didn't change, I'd have to expel the student. So I called her and let her talk to them. But working with your local pastor, remember one evening when the pastor called me and said, hey, look, a couple of us would like to come over and just talk to you about this situation. And I was a little uptight. I thought they were going to come and tell me I hadn't been doing so well. But they just wanted to come over and tell me they understand. They want to hear where I was at with the situation. And they just want to let me know they're supporting. Here's their perspective. Wow. That was wonderful. And so it can be a tremendous asset. I didn't feel alone. I knew that I could call these people for help. And I didn't have time to do what needed to be done. And yet, by getting community people to support, I could do what was needed. Counseling your students is always a challenge. There are resources available as well that you can read. I think of the book that ACSI puts out, Proverbs as a Counseling Tool. Again, I don't believe in throwing verses at students, but it is nice to be able to encapsulate a situation or a problem and say, you know, let's talk about what this verse means. And let's talk about what needs to happen in your life in order for this to take place. It helps me to kind of shrink it, condense it to the issue rather than spend a lot of time talking. There are many books out there that can be helpful in these. And if you'd like to know more, you can talk to me afterwards. You know, we need to know ourselves, we need to know our students, we need a framework for counseling and discipling students. Let me just finish by saying that working with students is going to get you mixed reviews. Mixed reviews. The first 5 years I taught, I had at least one student out of every graduating class who left the Lord. Came from Mennonite family, but they left. They're in the world today. And after a couple of years of watching that happen, I started thinking about the significance of my moments with that student. And I wondered if I was really doing what needed to be done. But again, recognizing too that I couldn't do everything. I couldn't make the choices. I think of one student who gave me a lot of grief all the 3 or 4 years I taught her in high school. And yet when she graduated, gave me a diary filled with poems and little thoughts on teachers. Okay, but she would have died before she gave me any compliment in those 4 years. Okay, she would never do that. I think of another student who I really enjoyed in high school, and today is in the world. I thought I was doing decently well with the student, but obviously it was about more than me. It wasn't just me. I think another student who graduated and just a few weeks ago got married, went to the Justice of the Peace, and got married. Spent hours with this person. Clearly, I really don't know the value of those hours I put into that person. Really don't know it. I'm going to trust God and say that hopefully it meant something. But I also have to be aware that I don't change people. I can speak the truth. I can be the right person. But God changes people. So may the Lord bless you as you work with your students.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.